Caitlin.
Hi, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm doing well. And unlike last week, I'm feeling much better.
And unlike last week, I'm not on day 5 of a terrible hangover. So we are already leaps and bounds ahead of where we were last time we recorded. I want to thank everyone who listened to our last episode. We got great response. Thank you to everyone who has reached out and is engaging with us on social media and talking about these books with us. And we actually heard from a few individuals who immediately went and bought Fiona Riley's book after we talked about it on the podcast. So that's what we're here for. That's so exciting.
I'm super stoked people picked up the book and the few people who wanted to talk about Media Darling. I think that's great. We will have to figure out a way that we can communicate with more than one person at a time through our shared social media. I'd like to point out, too, on the social media sites, unless I physically say it's me under a tip of a tongue, you usually handle anything that has a tip of the tongue in the title. Yeah. I will almost always comment as my actual handle because it's not tied to any other source, unlike Same Sex in the City, which has its own following and its own culture built behind it. So if you see a tip of the tongue, it's usually Caitlin. She's not a silent second party. She's the one leading the main title the whole time. So.
And I want to thank everyone for not pointing out that you could hear my cat in the background the entire time we were recording our last podcast. She's already messed up 3 takes of this recording.
So Caitlin, this week's book choice was yours.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of secondhand embarrassment for you to actively choose.
Yeah, so the book that we are reading is Claire Lydon's London Calling, and it was one of the first lesfics that I read, and it was actually the first time that I read a lesfic series and read the whole series kind of in one go. When I was rereading it this time to record this podcast with you, I realized how much secondhand embarrassment I was having. And all of you who know me know that I don't do well with that. It actively prevents me from watching a great deal of TV and movies. But there's something about lesfic where I can power through the secondhand embarrassment because I know eventually I'll get some good, steamy, passionate moments to sort of make up for my active discomfort.
Sure.
Yeah. So let me give us a little bit more information about the book. It was published by Custard Books in April 2014, so about 6 years ago. And this is book one of a pretty extensive series called the London Romance Series by Claire Lydon. And I believe there are 6 books altogether. And I will read us the publisher's summary. A breakup, a mix-up, will there be a makeup? Jess Sharp's life hasn't exactly gone according to plan. She's 32, unemployed, and single after a devastating breakup. She's also left Australia for London to live in her parents' spare room. Her chaotic life seems to be spiraling until she meets someone who could be a game changer. She's optimistic after a wildly successful first date, but far too much tequila and the ghosts of girlfriends past may drag her far below her lowest point. Can she win the race for romance without tripping? This is Claire Lydon's debut novel.
Really? I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's
a pretty freaking strong debut.
It's such a strong debut. It's punchy. It's funny. It's really witty. And our protagonist, it's written in first person. So we see everything through Jess's eyes. And she's seems pretty fully realized for a book character, which is interesting. So I think that's part of why I wanted to talk about this book with you, because it's an example of a lesbian romance novel where the action is a little quieter, the plot is a little less driven by external forces or external people, but instead what we get is this really rich look into Jess's mind in a way that we haven't talked about before.
Yeah, unlike the first three novels we discussed, Jess is a character that is, she's more than the greatest thing that's happened to her and her flaw.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, is that the best way to communicate it? We hear really kind of petty things come through her mind and her mouth sometimes, which is nice.
Yeah, she's hella judgy sometimes. Like, a lot of what we learn about her is through her own narration, and she's kind of a inconsistent narrator. So yeah. We're getting not just the lay of the land, we're not just getting descriptions of what's going on, we're also getting her snap judgments, which is really interesting. It really did feel like watching a close friend who you love to gossip with tell you, you know, watching them go about their dating life.
Yeah, she's also the first protagonist we've had that, you know, we get to watch the implosion of that late 20, early 30 something, oh, expletive, what is my life? And while not everybody goes through that, goodness knows I can project into it, you know, that oh, mm-hmm. crap, what do I do now?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, it was thoroughly effective for me there. It also opens in a way I think a lot of people can relate to in some way, which is you have something go horribly outside of where you thought and planned it to go, and then you have to decide if you're going to go back to something familiar because financially that allows some affordability to you. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think this episode we're not going to go plot point by plot point quite as much as we can for the last few books that we've read, just because, like we said, the action is a little quieter. But I think it's important to note that the first chapter opens with Jess commuting home. She's in Australia, and it's her girlfriend Karen's birthday, and Jess pops home to get Karen's birthday present and walks in on Karen having an affair, having sex, getting spanked by Paula, the roommate. So this is really the impetus for the whole book is Jess is just wildly betrayed by Karen, who she thought she was going to marry and be with forever. And the dissolution of that relationship is a big deciding factor for her to move back to London and live in her parents' spare room and restart her life.
Yeah, so she's not even moving back home. She's moving halfway across the globe. Mm-hmm. A lot of us in the U.S. just change states. I can't imagine jumping on a plane and doing it that way. Good grief. Mm-hmm. And she does have this pretty phenomenal, Jess, our leading character, has this pretty phenomenal chosen family. She also leaves behind in Australia and kind of what that means to reestablish friendships and reestablish acquaintanceships when you get back to a place that's semi-familiar to you. That's its own breakup and renegotiation system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I already want to jump to like four other points in the book. There's no way we're going to do this.
Yeah, there's no way to do plot. So let's talk about like the chosen family, because it's something that she leaves behind, but it's also such a big part of her journey in London is this chosen family and the people that she surrounds herself with. I haven't had a lesbian romance novel where I have to remember so many secondary characters' names and relationships.
Well, because we only get them when they're pertinent in that moment in this mm-hmm. book. We don't have them consistently being brought back into the novel to be pertinent.
No, that makes a lot of sense. It feels very much like we've been dropped into Jess's life, and so we get to see her day-to-day interactions with her friend, you know, her brother, her friend, her sister-in-law, her friend who's getting married, and it does feel like a real snapshot of what it is like to be in your late 20s, early 30s, and like being friends with people in many different parts of their lives. You mm-hmm. have the friend who's really secure and getting married. you have the brother with his wife and two kids living out in the suburbs, zone 4, which is pretty far if you're familiar with the London Tube map. Jess has her friend and roommate, Kate.
Who is her sister-in-law.
Sister-in-law.
Sister-in-law's sister. Right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's her brother's wife's sister is also the woman she eventually gets out of her parents' house and moves in with. And then she's also queer. And they connect in the web, the chart, whatever the hell you want to call it, you know, the true thing of, like, how you know you're in a queer community when you set down the paper and pen and you see how many different lines have to be made for you to have somebody in common romantically or sexually. And usually there's vastly more lines for the sexual connection over the romantic.
Yeah, there are so many instances in this book of us meeting one of Jess's friends and getting the note that they used to date, or she was an ex-girlfriend of a friend, or X, Y, and Z. And it felt so true to life. We all have stories of the 0 degrees of separation in the queer community, and it's bitten me in the ass a couple times. So I feel that really keenly. And
we don't, right? No.
No.
By the time I met you, I was in the relationship that I've been in now for.
Yeah, we don't intersect or, like, touch in the chart. And I don't believe I intersect with your spouse at all either.
My thought was maybe prior to spouse for that year. Spouse and I didn't know each other. I think you're one of the only other queer women in my life that I tried really hard.
Maybe I feel so keenly connected.
You tried really hard to what?
I tried really hard when I first was dating women and dating in kind of smaller pools before I moved to the city. I tried really hard to stay kind of outside of the chart. I just will never forget the first time I was trying to date in DC, and I had gone on a few Tinder dates and, like, online dates, and then was on a second date with a person, and they walked up to me and they were like, "Oh, do you know so-and-so? They say that they slept with you." And all of my efforts in that moment just were falling around feet.
Were spouse and I in the same bar as you the night that happened? I feel like we were all, no, this wasn't that. We need you to move to the big city and find a way to connect people really fast, Caitlin. Good job.
I'm just trying to connect the queer community together, Rebecca.
Well, so let's tie back to the book, because there was an entire time when you lived in DC with one of your roommates, and we would come to visit you, and DC has these random pockets where there is no public transit to get there, and you lived in one of these pockets, and we used to come and meet you, and then leave said pocket to eventually get to transit to go find a queer space, much like Jess does in this novel. Jess immediately starts entering queer spaces again to find people, yes, to shag, but also to hang out with. She finds them very easily. Mm-hmm. You leave this place you lived in, DC, and then the largest queer bar opens physically across the street from your front door the day, like, after you leave, which is just very fitting.
It's just the universe having it out for me, I guess. But yeah, Jess over and over finds and enters queer spaces, especially ones just for queer women, for lesbians. I am really always struck when I read this series and this book more than any of the rest in the London romance series, because it's so focused on markers of queer identity that we see in real life today, lesbian bars, queer bars, meetups, meetup groups, and those kinds of things that to me are so intrinsic to my lived experience don't really enter into other lesfic that I've read. But it was just really interesting. It's a different way to depict these women in relationships that it feels really, it makes the book feel really contemporary, even though it's several years old at this point.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier when we were sending each other notes, which we do throughout the week, and you had pointed out that this was published in 2014. And I had a moment where I honestly went behind you and I completely believed you, but I was like, wait, what? Because it doesn't the technology and the use of terminology and everything they do, nothing feels dated.
Right.
So this could easily take place today. You know, Jess leaving Australia to come back to London makes sense for her physical phone having very few numbers in it and that kind of being an outlier.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing, there's no technology that Lydon choose to use within this text that doesn't translate today. It's odd to me to think that this book came out the year we lived together.
Oh, that is funny. I didn't even like put that together.
Yeah,
that's really funny. The year that we lived together and we were desperately trying to find queer community in our new city.
Anywhere.
And we kept anywhere, literally anywhere and anything. And we kept ending up in some really enjoyable groups and meeting some really great people, but also some of the weirdest experiences that I've had.
So Jess meets people in queer spaces, which is great. And then her queer community continues to introduce her to new queer people. Kate, is that her roommate's name?
Yes, Kate is her roommate.
Kate continues to introduce her mm-hmm. to other people. So the thing that like propels action in this book is just day-to-day interactions with other human beings, which is super effective, yeah. Very true to life. And as two Americans across the pond on the other side, felt very easily relatable to. It makes reading any of Lydon's books accessible.
She, like you said, she's introduced to her love interest through Kate because she meets Lucy, who is a friend of Kate's at a gay bar. And Lucy is, you know, an optician by day and a quote unquote wannabe drag king by night. And has this transfixing smile, and they have instant chemistry and easy conversation. Of course, Lucy used to briefly date Caroline, who is now dating Kate. So there's this great, like, 0 degrees of separation. And there's also
That's two.
It's fine. Which is just really funny because Caroline and Lucy are really, really close despite having dated, which is also something that
That's so fucking queer. Like, that is so, so indicative of the queer community. Not everybody, but many of us are very good friends with somebody we once spent some intimate and quality time with.
Yes.
But, you know, that's a lot of emotional time to invest. And if you can get a friendship out of it that's semi-healthy at the end, mm-hmm. power to you. That's mm-hmm. but so queer.
Another thing that I love about this book is that Jess has a one night stand, which we don't really see a ton of in lesfic. Jess has a one night stand with someone who is not her love interest, so with someone who's not Lucy. She's set up by her friend Julia, who is professional, beautiful, straight, but described as a lesbian Pied Piper. She just keeps befriending lesbians, it seems like. So Jess gets set up with a woman named Angela, who goes by Ange, who is a lawyer. And they have a pretty good date. It has its awkward moments. I definitely had some secondhand embarrassment during this date. And Jess hates her laugh. She thinks it's shrill. She thinks it's loud. She just doesn't find it attractive. But they still go home together and have sex, which isn't bad. Angela is pretty good at what she's, you know, she's pretty good. But
I love where the two of us get tripped up. So Angela and she have great fucking yeah. chemistry. I'll just say it.
Yeah.
But she's not the morning after type of date.
No, and Angela likes Jess a lot more than Jess likes Angela.
Yes.
So.
And this is where the connections again happen. Even if you're yeah. in a big city, Ange works with Jess's good friend,
Julia,
who is getting married. So Ange and Jess are going to be circumnavigating the same space until Julia's wedding, which is a plot point in the book. But, you know, it's this community that's always ancestral, be it queer or not, when somebody is queer, because it's just tied. And so often I find with American writers, they make everything very insular when it happens in a small town. And I really appreciate Lydon for taking a city and saying, no, this stuff is still crazy insular. There may be millions of people in the greater, you know, surrounding area, but you're going to encounter the same 250 over and over and over again.
I like that Lyden isn't afraid to make her narrator a little annoying and a little unlikable.
Especially since it's told in first person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's such an interesting... So Jess makes some pretty terrible decisions. Like, she's going about her life and she's unpacking a lot of emotional turmoil and her family relationships, and she's really interested in Lucy, yet, you know, never calls her. And
so my friend,
yeah,
who's been on the dating scene more recently than me,
uh-huh,
do you follow the 3-day rule?
No.
Do you expect whomever you're talking to follow the 3-day rule?
Maybe I'm weird. Like, if I have a great date with a person and we exchange numbers and you just never respond, like, reach out to me or respond to me, I'm not going to then think that you're interested in me. And the next time I see you, when we run into each other, I'm going to be super icy.
3 days seems like a long time now, so maybe that is where the technology comes in. The idea of not texting somebody, mm-hmm, within 12 to 24 hours after the date seems like a long time.
Yeah, and like moments like that just made me kind of want to shake her, because on the one hand, she can't stop thinking about Lucy, and she, like, really likes her, and when she's looking at other women, she's comparing them to Lucy, and yet she won't ask the girl to dinner.
But Lucy also doesn't text her.
I know, it's
or call confounding. Her. Lucy eventually shows up to the cafe that, mm-hmm, Jess works at. You know, she left corporate America, or pardon me, can't say that in this episode because it's not America, but she left her corporate job and has taken on a job. She loves working at a cafe, learning to cook, working with great secondary characters. There's always really amazing secondary characters in lesfic. I think that's where the kindness exists in lesfic, always, is in the secondary characters.
Yes.
And she shows up with flowers, right? Like white roses?
No, so this book is tricky because, like we said, it's not a ton of action. So she does show up at Porter's at the cafe,
mm-hmm,
and they have like a flirty meet cute kind of thing. And then I'm pretty sure that she shows up maybe again with
she does white later. Flowers. The first time she shows up is the whole conversation of, oh, do you work near here? And she's like, yes. Well, not really.
Right.
And she eventually walks back with, so Lucy doesn't even call her. She eventually shows up at Porter's.
Mm-hmm.
Because somehow between the two of them, 3 days is too long, so one of them finally takes an action. That's some weird math. So, yeah, it didn't kick me out. I was just ready to shake something, you know?
Yeah, and I think I was ready. This book is a real test of patience, because we have a lot of quieter moments where Jess is doing a lot of thinking, doing a lot of comparisons. There's a lot of comparisons between Australia and London, and between straight relationships and queer relationships, and thinking, you know, Jess is definitely a thinker. In those quiet moments, I sometimes wanted to be like, get to the romance. Like, I want to see you interact with this girl.
Well, they meet each other. Jess has just left Oz to come to England. Lucy's on her way to Australia for vacation, for holiday.
Yeah.
So they are
ships in the night, just crossing paths. And
but at least there's another, because had it been another day in either direction, there's, mm-hmm, a chance that initial interaction would have never happened. So we have this meet cute, and then we have a standby processing.
Yeah. And so, yes, you're right, the Lucy's trip to Australia does account for some of the time that's passed before they reach out to each other.
They're British, they get real vacations, so she's legitimately gone for, you know, almost 2 weeks or whatever.
Yeah. And then
the 3-day holiday here.
Yes. And then kind of early on, when they're first, like, maybe even the second time Jess ever sees Lucy is by random, like, Lucy is walking down the street. It's after her vacation in Australia, and she's arm in arm with a tall blonde, and Jess sort of is like, oh no, she's met someone else. You know, that's too bad. We really connected. And then we later find out that that blonde was her cousin, mm-hmm. which is where, but the only reason that she knows that that's not Lucy's partner is because of the web of lesbian connection where Caroline, the partner of the, you know,
yeah. It's like, well, it's, and all of Lucy's family comes to visit in this novel because she has another person after the first night she and Jess hook up, you know, their first date turns into, hey, I can't come home with you. I have to go to the airport the next morning and pick up my cousin who's flying in from Canada.
Yeah.
And then turns into, fine, I'll come in for one drink. Oh, I shouldn't drink coffee again. I have to wake up to go to the airport. Oh, sure, you're having a beer too. We're falling in bed together and I'm getting up, well, falling in bed for a while and
yeah.
then sleeping for an hour or two. And then I have to get up and go to the airport to get family coming in from abroad. Yeah. So I like how fast sex happens in this book. Mm-hmm. It feels very true to form for a large percentage of the people I know in my life. Do not get me wrong. I enjoy a slow burn. I completely understand and know people who wait multiple dates to physically get intimate with other people.
Yeah.
Without divulging too much, sleeping with someone on the first date's not that odd to me. People do it.
Who among us?
Well, not among the two of us, apparently.
I am not a slow burn type of girl.
So, Caitlin, have you been to Great Britain? Have you been to England?
I have. I actually studied abroad there for a semester and a month in college.
I had to look up a lot of the slang. Like, I thought I was cool after watching a lot of BBC America, but obviously I'm not. Is there anything that you think I might have missed in here that is pertinent?
There were some moments where I did get kicked out because I had to take a beat to understand the slang. I am still confused. Maybe someone can help me with this. The reader is getting introduced to Kate, Jess is explaining how Kate and her bonded over being uncomfortable wearing flowing lilac bridesmaids dresses for the wedding of their siblings. And Kate is described as another lavender lady. And for the life of me, I don't know if it's lavender lady because the bridesmaids' dresses were both lavender / lilac, or if that's a slang for another lesbian.
Right, because I immediately go to Lavender Menace.
That's what I thought too, but I don't know. So, like, there are, like, little things like that where I was like, oh, okay. Just based on my very limited knowledge of slang, I still couldn't get it.
And then there are other things with context clues, like the hen party is basically what we call a bachelorette party, mm-hmm. right? So when we talk about secondhand embarrassment and things that... Can we talk about the hen party a minute?
Please.
So I'll give the little bit of the background in this. So Jess is going to Julia's hen party in Brighton, and Walsh happened to be in town. This is after they slept together the second time?
It's after.
Something like that.
Yeah, they've had like a couple really beautiful nights together, and they're super into each other.
Yeah. So Jess is the resident queer lady at this hen party with her dear friend. In the course of getting to the place they're going to party at that night, Jess finds out that Lucy's going to be in town, and Lucy wants to swing by and see her at the bar for, you know, a drink and run out. And that sounds really exciting. Well, then enter Ange, because Ange is part of this community and works with the bride-to-be. Ange and her group of friends enter the space and are cold and standoffish to Jess, as you probably would be to anybody who kind of slept and ditched. So you have this just chaos going on in the background of the woman you had slept with who's getting drunk and talking to you at the bar, and then the woman you're interested in who's going to swing by the bar who wasn't going to be in town, and then copious amounts of alcohol because it's a bachelorette party. And then because it's good drama, there is a kiss between the one night stand and our leading protagonist. And then our leading protagonist interest to be and possible girlfriend sees said kiss. And not even is it just like a kiss. They both participate in the kiss. There is an exchanging of tongues and body language. And Jess isn't the one who pulls away from the kiss first. We all get drunk and do stupid, but oh my god, that scene.
That scene was so hard to read because you knew it was going to be a disaster. We knew it was coming. We got the sense that Ange had unfinished business, unfinished feelings. I was surprised, but it fits with Jess's character that Jess participates in that kiss. I felt so bad for Lucy in that moment. But when Jess is later trying to explain herself, she doesn't even try to, she tries to explain herself, but she says, like, I didn't pull away. I was so shocked that I sort of just reacted instead of thinking. And I could understand how that would be your first response, but this is another decision where I was just like, I feel like Jess sometimes is so in the way of her own happiness and her own desires that I wanted to shake her.
Thank goodness for, I don't even know if it's thank goodness. There are moments with Lucy that in my head, I'm just, Jess is a train wreck. She's got to figure her stuff out. Won't get too deep, but there's a lot of projection into Jess around the same age too, to be honest. The whole time I'm watching Lucy in the background, I just want to scream, Lucy, get out, Lucy, get out, Lucy, get out. Jess has got to figure this stuff out. And if you're in the middle of it, you're going to keep getting burned. And she kind of does. And Jess grows exponentially from that moment towards the end of the book. And she has much more just strength at the situations around her. It really is these girlfriends of yesteryear past that keep popping up. It's not that she's the most wanted woman in the world. It's just that everybody's converging on each other at once. But I can't help but sometimes listen to Jess speak out loud and think the same way I am of honesty needs to come with an edit button. Because where people say they want you to be honest, the truth of the matter is when their emotions and their feelings are that exposed, honesty is a set of cleats instead of, you know, soft slippers. You just crunch people harder as you walk on them.
Yeah.
And it was just, oh my God.
And
Lucy
even says at one point when Jess sort of is making the first of a few different big gestures, Lucy says, you're so much drama. You have so much going on with you. Like, why do I want to be with this? I don't blame Lucy for taking that step back and saying, like, wait a minute, is this everyone around you or is this you? Is this my life now?
Yeah. So Leiden, unlike the other books we've talked about, and it may be a British thing, but the moments of intimacy in this book, the sexual acts in this book, are completely described in a physical way, unlike the other three books we've discussed so far. You have these very sensual acts with the first two authors we discussed with Braden and Beers. And then you have these just carnal desire acts we discussed with Riley, paired with emotion and paired with vulnerability. And then you have Leiden, who just is like, here we go, and we're going to talk about the physicality, and I'm not going to talk about softness or curvature or, I don't know, it was a nice reprieve for a minute, just kind of, just much like Jess's language, it's just there, it's just...
What's a good way to describe it? You're right, it's so physical, it's so focused on the body, and Leiden does a good job of, these are attractive bodies, but they're not perfect bodies.
Oh, good grief, God bless.
Yeah, so we don't have these rhapsodic moments of like, she's the most, you know, she has abs even though she never has time to go to the gym, or she was the softest person, and there's no...
Leiden's characters bite and lick without it being a heightened erotic moment.
Yeah.
It's just a sexual moment. It's not eroticism.
Yeah.
It's just sex.
And there's like spanking,
Licking the knees.
Licking the knees. And, like, there's a great line that really sticks out to me. It's stuck on every time I've read it, where Jess and Lucy are having the really tough conversation of Lucy saying, I don't know if I want to be with you because you just made out with this girl at a bar and you're, you know, X, Y, and Z. And Jess is staring at Lucy's legs, which are in, like, a pair of slacks, like, tight pants. And she's like, I can't believe I was just licking that leg a little bit ago, and now it's so far. And it's just such a moment where there's no there's not a ton of sentimentality behind that thought. It's so connected to their physical time together, but it's not sentimental in a way that those kinds of descriptions can sink into a little bit.
Yeah, sex is not done in this novel initially, if ever, as an act of declaring romantic love. Mm-hmm. It is sex for sex sake, which is kind of nice to read sometimes, to be honest. Yeah. Which is also why we can have the one night stand scene, because it's, even though I'm not that into her, I would like to take care of some of this endorphin rush I need to handle, and let's just go get it on.
Yeah. And it separates out the physical attraction to a person from being attracted to a person's personality, which I think is also, so I'm saying the same thing that you just said, but, like, you can be, like, physically attracted to a person and not want to be with that person and still want to fulfill your desires with them.
Oh, completely. And that's so true to life.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue true to some relationships if people are being honest as to why they didn't work out. You know, yeah. We want to handle, I think as Americans, we've been taught over and over again through whatever weird Puritan background that most of us kind of indirectly get brought up in, that acts of sexual things need to also be acts of intimacy, and those things are not tied together all the time. And I find with a lot of literature I read from countries that are not our own, sometimes sex is just sex. And I do appreciate that, because I think in our friend group, we talk about it that way. But then when there are strangers present, we mute it again as if it's not healthy to say that or to think that or to practice that. There's some weird, weird ingrained stuff in us as a culture. And apparently in the world of lesfic, I'm noticing it more and more. So in the background, mm-hmm. on top of this narrative of everything we have going on as well, Karen has popped back up because Jessica decides to go
online.
Karen,
the Australian ex-girlfriend. The ex-girlfriend who cheated on her with her roommate. She sends her an email immediately.
I'd like to talk about this email.
And okay.
Karen sends Jess an email and prefaces it with, she has received therapy. Therapy is an amazing tool for people who have access to it and can find a therapist that works well with them. There are a lot of things that have to go into good mental health. Mm-hmm. And if you are lucky enough to be in a position where you can have assistance with it, it can give you really phenomenal tools. I thought this email for the first two thirds was incredibly helpful. When it ended with, I still love you, I miss you, I think Karen has a lot left to go to her therapist about. Because honestly, if you are receiving the tools and the insight that therapy can help provide, you should be in a position where you understand that reaching out to somebody you harmed is you actively choosing to tear open whatever healing mechanism they've started to use and re-expose wounds that you helped facilitate in the creation of.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when Jess reads this email and Karen's like, hey, I'm sorry, I want to tell you that I'm holding myself accountable, I'm like, yeah, look at this writing. This is phenomenal. Hey, I still love you. Nope, nope, nope. The train went off. It went off the tracks. And I'm coming to England. I want to see you. Nope, that train is somewhere in an ocean now. It has become a ship. It is not
a sinking ship.
It's down. It is not doing the thing that it has been built to do. And you know it's a plot device, and we're going to end up seeing the ex who's going to come back. by the time we do see Karen, she's kind of stalking Jess. She shows up at the cafe at 7:30 in the morning. She's declaring, hey, I still love you. She shows up before the wedding with a box of Tim Tams because she knows they're Jess's favorite. All of this is just a big old mess. And also probably the gayest thing I've ever read in any of these books. Nothing is more queer than not being able to move past a relationship that you screwed up and thinking that you have the permission to get back in. I can say between the two of us, we have both either been there or been with somebody who tried to be there. And I can't name a single person in my life who hasn't had the crazy person or been the crazy person. So that was incredibly gay.
Yeah. I mean, regret is a powerful agent of action. And I loved that even as Karen was trying to get Jess back and was kept showing up everywhere, her big actions were still so mundane. It
yeah, the grand gestures in this book are just honesty.
Yeah, and accountability. And
accountability. I mean, even when Jess has her grand gesture, she shows up at Lucy's place of employment with poor Lucy crying on this chair as she's hearing this. And she's just, hey, I was stupid. And I want to tell you I was stupid and why I was stupid. And I want to hold myself accountable. And I want to do this correctly. So I'm going to give you multiple days to choose to back out.
Right.
But I want to take you on a date. Oh. And you need to tell me 24 hours before the date via text. You don't even have to call that you don't want to do it. And we won't. Healthy, healthy, wonderful actions. This is fantastic. Like, take note, people. This is how you do it correctly. You give people what you'd like, how their feelings matter, and out that doesn't involve them being unsafe. For everything that was awkward, somehow there was so much kindness and accountability. Different, again, it's not the like rock on your window, boombox above your head grand gesture, but this works better for me right now.
Yeah, it fit so well with these characters. It fit with the world that we'd been plopped into. Yeah, I mean, it's just, oh, Karen. I do keep coming back to Karen and her like misguided attempts to get Jess back. And
well, there's that great line, that whole thing in the cafe when Karen says X and Jess counters with, no, go talk to your therapist, because Jess was saying immediately what I was thinking as I was reading it two lines later when I would catch up. But as they go into this like cyclical argument, eventually Jess says something to the sound of, she says no to Karen. She's like, I don't love you. I have this other life. And then there's a line with, do we ever get rid of the taste of ex-lovers?
Right.
It's just perfectly worded. I mean, not the way I'm saying it. That idea that no matter how much you've moved on, that person still enters a space and just a flood of who you were with them, who they were to you, it's just always part of your life, no matter how much you cut the rest of it off. And the idea of it as a taste, you know, they say the sense of smell is so strong, but somebody walking in a room and that flashback of like what it feels like to kiss them or, you know, those intimate moments you have with each other. I think it's really, it works really, really well. You and I focus a lot on chosen families when we can, and we allude to awesome parents in books when they're there. This novel has a different trajectory when it comes to a protagonist's family and the place that family plays in their life. I think both of us are going to bow out a personal narrative in this.
Yeah.
Are you in a position to talk about this without talking about personal narrative?
Yes, I can do that. Can you do that?
I can do that. Just consent's awesome. And I believe in consent. So Jess's parents are present. They're around. They just kind of gloss over her sexuality and they don't really talk about the people she's seeing or what she's doing. And they do hold her to a standard where everybody else's life is more interesting and other people's girlfriends are more interesting.
Yeah, I think if I were to summarize the relationship throughout most of the book with a scene, it's when Kate and Jess are having lunch or dinner with...
It's like Sunday brunch or whatever.
Sunday brunch with Jess's mom. And Jess's mom asks Kate, like, oh, are you dating someone? Well, you know, I hear you have a new girlfriend. And she's really attentive to Kate. And she's really interested in hearing about Kate's girlfriend. And Jess goes, oh, well, I have a new person that I'm really excited about. I have a, like, she's not my girlfriend, but I want to bring her around. Maybe I'll bring her, you know, to the next family brunch or to the next celebration. And her mom goes, yeah, that's fine. You can bring a friend.
Oh.
That's really sets the stage. Like that crystallizes what this relationship is like. And in the end, her mom does, there's never a conversation where, at least I don't remember a conversation where it's acknowledged between the two of them, but that this is hurtful or that Jess's mom has messed up. But there is a conversation where Jess's mom kind of uncomfortably says, you can bring your person to, yeah, you know, we want to meet the people in your lives.
Her mom meets her in her space on her terms, not on like family, in a family joint space, and says, you know, hey, I see you without seeing you. And there's even a moment where things could be emotional and there could be so much more said, but having that conversation that deep at that time with that announcement,
mm-hmm,
would almost be too much. So they both, Jess and her mom, reach for each other's hands and kind of have this, I'm not going to cry, but I want to cry exchange. The absolute kindness, I'm going to use kindness, in that moment, of a parental figure who still can't say it, but actively seeks to start a conversation to say, I'm trying. I'm actively telling you I'm trying, and I'm holding myself accountable to seeing you and the things in your life that are important and the people in your life that are important.
Mm-hmm.
We talk a lot about these books and where they become lifelines for people. And any parental figure, if they're eloquent or not, saying, I will try, is always a fucking lifeline.
Yeah.
Pardon my language, but I want that to stick.
Yeah.
It is always a lifeline. And anytime a parental figure says it, even if they believe that their child already knows, is vital. Mm-hmm. Because you have to hear those words out loud. You have to hear your value, your importance, and your worth physically out loud by the people who love you. We have a lot of comparable people in our personal social medias that are not the ones we share with here on the podcast. Have you seen the retweet that's been going out this week?
Yeah, the one that's like gone viral about queer people.
We basically learn to pretend from day one, and then we have to unpack as we get older what about ourselves was real and what we were pretending to do in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
I think the majority of the people in my life, and I'd love to hear how you're doing, if you're comfortable with it. I know when I read it and then I saw the notes, I'm a person who's lived a lot of places. And I have the opportunity and privilege to say I have a lot of really great acquaintances and friends throughout the U.S. and a couple in other countries. Everybody's reposting this and retweeting this. And I think there's this unified... It has done a thing where it has expressed something we all feel, but we never say to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then that tweet going viral recently, paired with rereading this book to discuss it today, that scene with the mom just felt so important. And I don't know how important it was to Lydon when she wrote it, but it's just this vitality of verbal affirmation,
mm-hmm,
paired with constantly trying to mold yourself to be comfortable to the people you're in front of.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a scene that ended up taking on like a lot more emotional importance to me than I was kind of expecting it to.
Yeah. This scene was an interesting one for me to read because it's easy to for me to separate like the personal from what I'm reading, because so often the family relationships in lesbian romance novels are like one side of the seesaw or the other. They're either like really perfect and the family is so supportive, and you know, they'll hand their daughter a dental dam as she's on her way to go talk to someone, or it's the opposite. Did I break you? Or it's the opposite, where the parents are like ruthless and evil, and you know, they never change and they never like never see the error of those actions.
Or they're dead.
Or they die. Or they're dead.
So many dead parents to 30-year-olds in these books.
So many. And so for me, it's comfortable for me to read the like those kinds of, I'm going to call them like a fairy tale kind of parental figure, because they kind of inhabit those same tropes. So for me, it was really interesting to read this one, because it felt a little bit, it felt so real. Like it felt like something that you could lift and put into another type of book. And it's a scene that I think should be held up when people sort of shit talk romance novels, and they shit talk like the place of these books, and they're not doing anything important and they're just X, Y, and Z. It's moments like this where you want to say like, no, actually, like these are really important scenes, and it's so important to have the highs of these beautiful romances with these kind of middle ground, like tough but honest moments of what it's like to be a queer person today.
We always get way too serious at one point.
I know, right?
I shouldn't say way too serious. We always get pretty serious at one point. We edit around that, but I think I'm keeping most of this in.
I think we should.
I love that the one time Jess is pretty quiet is when Mom is trying to use the least amount of words to say the biggest thing to her.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this scene also explains, or like this whole, her whole relationship with her parents explains so much of why Jess is so introspective about what it means to be a lesbian. She thinks a lot, and we get a lot of descriptions about like, well, lesbians in Australia are different from the ones in London because of X, Y, and Z, or this is what it's like to be doing the types of dates that I'm doing. And when you see her unpacking herself, figuring out who she can be as in this new life and what it means to be inhabiting the spaces that she's inhabiting, that kind of internal monologue that we're treated to makes a lot more sense, because that's what a lot of us just do. Like we're constantly thinking about like, what is my place in the world? How do I fit? How is my relationship with the people around me in this moment impacting who I am? It's deep. Shit's deep.
Yeah. And we don't learn too much about Lucy really in this novel. We don't know anything about her family, right?
No, not really.
But again, yeah. We haven't been together that long by the time we get to the end of it. So it's still, it never kicked me out. I don't have questions about that.
No, I don't have questions about that. I don't know if I have too many questions about this book. I have things that gave me pause.
Claire Lydon likes the word dyke in this novel.
She really does. That's really fair to say. Jess uses it as a descriptor for herself, for the people around her, and for places that she enters. There's a great moment where Julia, her straight friend, which is also like an interesting point now that I think about it. Julia, her friend who is setting her up with Angela, the lawyer with the shrill voice, Julia calls Angela a lesbian and Jess asks, oh, what's the, like, why she's not a dyke. And Julia says, well, you know, the difference between a lesbian and a dyke is 50,000 pounds.
You have to pay for the privilege of having a term that's less derogatory used to describe you.
I mean, that's the sentence. That's what.
Well, I mean, as two Americans, how do you feel about the term dyke?
I don't use it for myself. I don't have any like negative connotations with it, and I know the history of it. And I appreciate moments when it's used to be really like uplifting. But like I said, it's not something that I use to talk about myself or like the people around me. What about you?
I've definitely used and called people baby dykes before. BDs. The first time I heard the term, somebody called me one, and I don't think of it as a negative within the community. I have plenty of people in my direct life who wear the term dyke very, very proudly. My immediate relationship with the word outside of my baby gay years, I present not femme. And the number of strangers in various situations, when they are uncomfortable, who feel that they have the right to use that word as an adjective, noun, and verb when they're passing me. I don't want this to get too serious, but it is a word that I only hear when I have short hair and somebody feels unsafe. Mm-hmm. Because nobody says it to me even within the queer community, because the people within those spaces usually self-identify, and they most of the time ask what terminology I prefer. And more often than not, instead of even getting dyke, people just ask me my pronouns, which are she and her. It's always a word of rebellion in my life, or a word that's supposed to be harmful.
I think when I was reading this book for the first time and I saw Lyden use the word dyke so liberally, it was exciting. It felt like it immediately put me in a time and a place and a type of friend group and a type of cultural I felt like I could identify Jess, like I could sort of picture Jess, and
you knew which stereotype she was within the group of people you spent
right on. And what she was proud to claim from the community as like part of her own identity, like there. And
But I don't know if Jess's character ever uses it for anything but descriptors, and it's always judgment, because she uses the term drama dyke a couple times. I really like the alliteration. I'm actually going to hold on to that. Hopefully never say it out loud.
There's a couple different moments where she's like getting dressed for dates and she's with gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll make comments that are like, do I look like a dyke?
Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of reference to her not wanting to come across too much of one thing. But even at the wedding in the end, isn't she in a suit? She's in white pants and a checkered tie or a checkered jacket. One of them's checkered.
Yeah.
So there's a lot. Jess has got some stuff to unpack.
Yeah, there's a lot about presentation, both of Jess's own like identity and how she views others. My own bias, it imbued her with a kind of confidence in her own queer identity that colored how I saw her as a character and how I saw her place in this queer world that was being created by Lyden.
I don't have very many questions about this novel. The questions I have all dealt with me, like what's the difference between a kiss and a schnog? I had to look that up. But
yeah, I forgot that pants in British slang is underwear. So,
oh, that makes so much more sense.
Yeah, so she's taking off her jeans and then she doesn't have a pair of pants on underneath.
That makes so much more sense. I just thought, okay.
Yeah, so I had a few funny moments like that where, since we don't have any questions, is there like in one sentence, what was your favorite thing about this book?
The trajectory always made sense.
I like it.
Five words. There you go. Yourself?
I don't think I'll be as succinct as you, but I liked that all of the conflict was internal. It wasn't a relationship that was hemmed in by these wild external forces. It was really a story about a person coming to terms with their life and making changes that they wanted to see. And you see the fruit of that, not just in her career and not just in her happiness, but also in being healthy enough to have a good relationship at the end.
Yeah. You have read the next five. I might need to dive in, especially
between
this narrative. So.
Yeah.
And I might need to dive in means I'm going to go read them. We usually wrap every episode with what we are currently reading or what's in the queue. I always go first. How about you this week?
Okay. So I just need to say it. I just finished my first book by Rachel Spangler. I finished in development like at 1 a.m. last night. There's a lot to unpack there. In my queue, I have Chef's Special by Susan X. Meager, which was a suggestion from one of my followers on Same Sex in the City. So thank you. I'm excited to read this. And it feels really fitting for the news coming out of Buckingham Palace today. The other book that I am going to start reading is A Royal Romance by Jenny Frame. What about you, Rebecca?
I just finished Temptation by Chris Bryant, and I am currently reading Paper Love by Jay.
And where can people find you if they want to connect with you about any of the books on social media?
I'm most eloquent on Instagram, which is Rebecca Writes a Romance. And then if you find me on Twitter, I will either pay you a lot of compliments or email back and forth with apparently a ton of typos and way too much enthusiasm when I talk to you if you're an author. And that Twitter handle is Rebecca A-T-T-T pod. So Rebecca A Tip the Tongue pod. So yeah. Yourself, where do I find you, Caitlin?
I am most often on Instagram. You can find me at Same Sex in the City or on Twitter at Same Sex the City. Fingers crossed. I'm still holding out hope that I can get a better handle. So if you want to get more information about the podcast or see what Rebecca and I are reading, you can find us on Instagram at A Tip of the Tongue, or you can find us on Twitter at ATTTpod. So that's A3Ts pod. Thank you to everyone for listening, and I can't wait to see what we get to talk about next week.
I can't. And, you know, go reach out to Leiden. She has a really prolific canon of work that she's written. And she's super awesome to follow on social media and responds to messages. Probably the first lesbian author I ever talked to via the interwebs, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so. I think same for myself. So go read all of her books. If you have read the London Romance series, hit us up. We would love to talk about all of it.
Yeah, according to our schematics, we usually respond within 3.5 hours.